So we've all kind of made a journey to get here, to arrive here for the retreat. And it can be a little bit tiring to make all the preparations, come and let everything go. And so, you know, there may be some momentum of that preparation that you experience in the first day or so. Gil mentioned the tiredness that may happen, but also sometimes quite a bit of spinning mind, of restlessness, as we think, oh, did I take care of that? Did I lock the doors? Did I make sure I called the cat sitter? So the mind can also spin in that way. And yet here we are, we've landed here, and we're beginning a journey together. A journey in silence together. A journey, an inner journey. Often when we think about a journey, the idea or analogy of a journey. On a journey, we often have somewhere we're going. We have a destination that we want to get to. And when we're going somewhere, it's really helpful to know, first of all, where we're going, to have a sense of the direction or the orientation of where we're going. And then it can be helpful to have some tools to help us get there. Map, compass. And then some skills. How to read the map, how to use the compass. As I was reflecting on this analogy, I realized or thought back on when I was a kid. And we did a lot of traveling in the car, did a lot of journeying. And I saw my parents looking at these maps, and I was fascinated by these maps and asked to be instructed. And so they gave me lessons, and I would spend hours in the car, you know, looking at the map, seeing the next road, looking at the signs on the road, where are we? Oh, the next exit says that. Can I find that on the map? Oh, there we are on the map. So some skills needed to be transmitted. You know, you can't just get a map and a compass and know what to do with them. You have to have some training to use them. You also might need help along the way. If there's a detour, some construction, you can't quite follow the route that you'd planned out, sometimes you need to ask somebody for help. In our spiritual journey, our journey into really waking up, our journey into experience. Our journey into our minds, really. It is a journey of understanding our minds. We often think of having a destination, sometimes somewhere we'd like to get to, more concentration or some idea of some place we'd like to be that's not here. And yet all we have in our journey of awakening is this moment. There's nowhere else. And so really our journey here together is really a journey into now. We may feel like, oh, everybody can do that, you know, I can be here now. And yet there's so many hidden views, ideas, perspectives that influence our relationship to now that really keep us from really entering into this moment. We are exploring what it means to wake up to what's actually here, what's actually happening in our bodies, in our minds, without prejudice, without confusion. And yet, our minds are full of prejudice and confusion. And so that too, the journey begins by recognizing, oh, there's confusion in the mind. There's aversion in the mind. There's prejudice in the mind. We make this journey by opening to what's here. It's what's already here. Can we actually do that? Can we open to what's really here in a moment rather than what we'd like to be here? What we'd like to have happening? It takes courage. It takes persistence. And it takes some sense of resolve. Sense of this is important. This is the direction I would like to head. Interestingly, it's not somewhere else. It's not a direction, that kind of resolve or that direction or orientation isn't about somewhere else. It's really about here. And so what does it mean? How do we orient to here and now? And so if we want to make this journey, we need to find some tools that help us orient to here and now, help us orient to waking up to things as they are. The Buddha offered a number of ways to talk about this journey. And one of those ways is our theme for the retreat. It's a list, one of the many, many lists that the Buddha used in his teaching. This one is called the Four Determinations. We could say the Four Resolves, or perhaps the Four Foundations, which is how it's translated here. The word in Pali is adhitana, which means something like to stand firmly. So resolve is a good translation for it, or determination, a good translation. Bhikkhu Bodhi has chosen to translate it as with the term foundation, which I think also has some value. I'll explore these different words in a moment, but I'll read these two paragraphs, which will form the basis for our theme for the week. This person has four foundations. They are the foundation of wisdom, the foundation of truth, the foundation of relinquishment, and the foundation of peace. One should not neglect wisdom. One should preserve truth, should cultivate relinquishment, and train for peace. We can look at these foundations, these resolves, as kind of setting our compass, setting our direction in order to enter into the present moment fully. It takes wisdom to understand what it means to enter into this moment fully. It takes a radical truthfulness to begin to recognize when we are deceiving ourselves, fooling ourselves, limiting ourselves. It takes letting go of so much of the ways we habitually engage with the world, relinquishing patterns and habits of greed, aversion, confusion. And it takes a deep commitment to peace. So these we can think of as directions or priorities, maybe, for our path, priorities for our practice. An orientation for our journey. Wisdom, truth, relinquishment, and peace. In thinking of these as resolves, what's a resolution? A resolve, you know, I think one of the ways we often relate to the word resolve or resolution is from New Year's resolutions. You know, the upcoming transition of the year's end to the new year, many of us will make some kind of New Year's resolution. I'm going to do X. I'm going to exercise more. I'm going to work less. I'm going to sit more. I'm going, whatever, you know, we do. We orient towards, this is the direction. This is the direction I'd like to go. In our practice, and actually if we think about the way resolutions, a New Year's resolution works, you know, if we don't hold those or keep those at the forefront of our minds, they often vanish. They last maybe for a week or two, a month if we're really firm in our resolve. But if we don't keep it at the forefront of our mind every day going forward, it will peter out. It will let go. And so this points to me to the way we work with these resolves, these determinations. They do have the purpose of setting our direction over a long time. You know, it's not a moment of exploring or opening to wisdom, truth, relinquishment, and peace, and boom, we're awake. It's a long journey and a gradual awakening. The Buddha really emphasized the slow and slow, gradual nature of the path, and yet the very strong momentum and direction that comes with repeated practice and orientation towards our what we're heading towards. And so these resolves can kind of shape our commitment to practice, shape our commitment to what we need to, how we need to orient to walk this journey. In a way, I see these as both map and compass, these tools, these qualities of mind. They are both map and compass. And we need to use them skillfully. So our resolves over a long period of time can shape our choices. You know, if you have a New Year's resolution, I'm going to exercise more, for instance, that intention in the mind, that direction of the mind will, you know, continuing to remind yourself, if you reminded yourself daily, yes, I've committed to exercising more, I've committed to keeping myself healthy in this way, then that reminder every day or several times a day might shape your choices. I'm going to do this today. And so while these resolves point us in a direction over a long stretch of time, they shape our choices now. And it's important that we know that this is really where the practice unfolds, in the moment. Each choice happens now. Each moment we make a choice, do we orient towards wisdom? Do we orient towards confusion? Do we orient towards honesty? Do we orient towards deceiving ourselves? I had a kind of a moment a few weeks ago where I think I was washing dishes in my kitchen, and a little bit of impatience arose while I was doing this. Just a little flash of impatience. And in that moment, I kind of recognized, you know, I don't know how long I have to live. This might be my last moment. Is this the way I want my mind to be with as I die? Is this impatience what I would want for my final mind state? And the answer, of course, was no. And that kind of orientation towards what is my priority? What is my, how do I want to live my life in this moment? It's like, this moment is all we have. How do we want to live our lives? And so this is our exploration. Commitment, resolve is a living thing. It's not something we say once and then let go of. We keep it. We need to keep it alive in our minds, this direction that we're headed. And so this notion of resolve, determination for wisdom, for truth, for relinquishment, for peace, point us in the direction that we'd like to head. And they also as they get stronger, as those strengthen in our hearts and minds, the word foundation feels like a nice one. They become these foundations on which we live our lives. They're no longer so much work. It's more of a natural, becomes more of a natural orientation to how we choose to live. Then they have really become a foundation for our life. In some ways, too, I feel like these orientations are not only a kind of a compass direction, but also they reflect what we might call the goal of practice. They are a reflection, the mind of wisdom, the mind that has opened to truth, the mind that has relinquished greed, aversion, delusion, the mind that opens to peace is a reflection of a mind that's free. And so this points to another way I feel these are very beautiful expressions of the Dharma, these qualities that we'll be exploring this week. We not only walk the path with these qualities in mind, they are the path, and they are a reflection of where we're headed. So the path reflects the goal. To be wise, we cultivate wisdom. To be truthful, we cultivate truth. To be peaceful, we act peacefully, even as we're not quite there yet. And so these determinations, these resolves support us on our journey into now. And some additional supports for our journey into now are the refuges and the precepts, which Gil and Jill will talk to us about.
So the refuges and the precepts are the support, one of the supports for retreat practice and for a life. There's a, when I studied with a Zen master named Robert Aiken Roshi, he had this wonderful teaching that he said, a lot of people come to me and they say they like to bring their practice into their life. And he said, at some point, it's not the issue, it becomes not bringing your practice into your life, but your life into your practice. And the idea being that you center yourself in your practice, and then you, that's an orientation, that's a place that you put tremendous value in, like this is where you feel most authentic, perhaps, and then your life has to fit into that. Because you know your life fits into truth and peace and wisdom and all that. And so the refuges represent a kind of this, the heart of this idea of what we're going to, you know, the heart of our heart, you know, who we are and where we find our home. And so at the beginning of a retreat, we often remind ourselves of these supports. And when things get difficult in retreat, sometimes remembering the refuges and remembering the precepts as a kind of the base support for it all can kind of help us see it through to the other side of some challenge we have. Because it's good to know that it's not just up to you personally. There's a wider container for a wider process going on here that's not a personal process. And the refuges and the precepts are this kind of transpersonal phenomena that we're participating in that support us. If you orient yourself by the refuges and the precepts, the refuges and the precepts will support you, will kind of guide you and help you find a way, even though you can't figure out how that's done. The refuges are three: the refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And refuge in the Buddha, we say refuge in the Buddha, but since the ancient times, it was understood that when you take refuge in the Buddha, you're taking refuge in the awakening of the Buddha. What the thing that made this person who lived in ancient India a Buddha was his awakening. And so to take refuge in your capacity to be awake, even though if you don't feel very awake, you have a capacity. Or take refuge in your capacity to be free, to have, you know, inner freedom. You might not feel very free, but there is a momentum, there is a heart's desire to be free. Given half a chance, your heart and your mind will find itself to freedom. And a lot of practice is getting out of the way so that this inner phenomena can unfold for you. And so we take refuge in a capacity, in a nature, if you will, a nature we have, our inner nature of being awake, of being free, of being wise, being at peace. And as we'll see as we talk about these four foundations, four resolves, that these things are really the alternative way of holding our lives, that it's an alternative to me, myself, and mine. So to take refuge in or to identify with awakening. The third, skip the second one for a moment, the third refuge is Sangha. And it means many things. I know for me in my practice that I have been tremendously supported by the community of people I've practiced with. And I could not have practiced to the degree to which I practice without the support of other people who practiced side by side, people who are my teachers, people who were further ahead than me in the practice. I was inspired. I was lovingly, or not so lovingly at times, challenged, but appropriately challenged. I was. I learned from other people. I got feedback from other people. I was mirrored in other people. And so it kept my momentum going in practice and helped me sit up, you know, late at night or day after day on retreat, and to integrate this whole Dharma thing into my life. And so Sangha is a community of fellow practitioners. It's also those people who have really tasted or experienced the truth of the Dharma in their own lives, or have made it their own, made the truth themselves, who have kind of witnessed the possibility of freedom. And there are people who can be very inspiring to know that how far they've gone and how deeply they've delved into this freedom and compassion and joy and peace that comes with Dharma practice. And so take refuge in this community of people who goes back to the time of the Buddha. I find it very meaningful for me to, when I chant the refuges, or even sometimes when I'm on retreat, to think that they're horizontally, there are people all over the world who are probably chanting the refuges at the same time, or sitting meditating at the same time, on retreat at the same time. And then kind of vertically, there have been people who have been doing that for hundreds and hundreds of years, right back to the Buddha. And so we step into this world here. It's a familiar world. It's a known world. It's a world that many, many people have walked in. So you're not alone when you do this. And believe it or not, it's very unlikely that what you're experiencing is going to be 100% unique. Like you're the first person on the planet who gets concentrated or doesn't get concentrated, or the first person on the planet who, I don't know. There are people probably gone through many of the same things as you, and the challenges and the joys. And just know you have company. And it's, people have seen it through and found the freedom. And then in between the Buddha and the Sangha is the Dharma. And I kind of like to think sometimes the Dharma is the bridge between these two. Between awakening and our life, our communal life, is the Dharma, is the practices, the truths, the teachings that support our awakening and support our living a life of wisdom. That there is truths that can unfold if we align ourselves to them, that lead us to awakening, and which lead us to an awakened life in our community life. And it's a kind of brilliant that we have the Dharma, the teachings, the truth, natural unfolding of things that also supports us. And that also operates kind of underneath or around, or, it's bigger. The Dharma is bigger than the I, you, yourself, and mine. Kind of just a small little sense of self we can have. And to know that there's more forces operating here than meets, your little eye, is very helpful and supportive. And to take refuge or take support or to be oriented or to be appreciate that there's much more here than your individual efforts. You offer your sincere efforts and the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha will support you. So I'll lead you in the chanting of the refuges, and then Jill can introduce you to the precepts, and we'll take those as well. So I think that enough of you know this, that why don't we do it together, since we're here, we're all in it together here, right? And those of you who don't know it, what we're going to do is we're going to chant in the ancient Buddhist language the three refuges. First, we do what's called a salutation to the Buddha. Just say, hey, homage to the Buddha. And then we do that three times. And then we do the refuges in Pali and Buddha, Dharma, the Sangha. Gacchami means to go. Saranam means refuge. And then we'll do it three times. The second time we add the word second time in front, which is in dutiyampi. And the third time we add third time in the front, and that's tatiyampi. So if you don't know it, you get full credit for humming along. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddham saranam gacchami. Dhammam saranam gacchami. Sangham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi Buddham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi Dhammam saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi Buddham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi Dhammam saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi Sangham saranam gacchami.
So in New Zealand, where I was brought up, the native Maori people have a tradition of weaving beautiful baskets to keep their treasures in, their taonga. And sometimes at the start of a retreat, I feel like we come together as a group of individuals and then we start to weave a container for us to find our treasure, to develop our treasure in. And the precepts I think of as a kind of a structure that allow us to weave ourselves around, that help us really create a sacred container for this powerful transformative work of developing wisdom and compassion. So the commitment to ethical conduct is really what supports our work together, the sense of safety that's so necessary for going deeply inward. And it can be easy to take the precepts for granted, thinking, well, of course, I'm not going to kill, I'm not going to steal, I'm not going to lie. We can just kind of check all those boxes. But on retreat, we really have an opportunity to practice them on more and more refined levels. So the first one, to refrain from killing living beings, is really an invitation to practice more and more refined mindfulness, to start to tune into all the other life forms that we share this retreat space with, not just our fellow human beings, but the creatures outside, the small animals and reptiles and insects that we share this beautiful space with. It can be an invitation to refine our mindfulness practice, noticing where we walk, for example, outside, noticing when there are beings inside that may need carefully escorting outside. It's an invitation to take more care, to really refine this beautiful commitment to non-harming. And in the same spirit, with the invitation to undertake the training to refrain from taking that which is not given. It can sound like a cumbersome way of saying not stealing, but it's an invitation not just to help ourselves to things, but to really consider, is what I'm using here freely offered? For example, we might be doing a job in the kitchen and seeing some delicious food laid out there and think, oh yeah, it's freely offered, it's out on the counter, and help ourselves. But the question is it really freely offered? So again, we see this refining of the mindfulness practice to really notice, what's our intention here? Similarly, with the third one, to refrain from sexual misconduct in the setting of a retreat, that means complete abstinence from sexual activity, not acting out on that energy, not going outward with that energy, so really giving each other space, keeping our energy contained and within, and giving each other permission to really go inwards. That too is a beautiful offering. And then the fourth one, to refrain from false speech, harsh speech, abusive speech. Again, in the context of a retreat, it refers to noble silence. So we've really made the commitment to, again, keep our energy inwards, to not use devices, computers, laptops, phones. And we may think, well, it's easy because I'm going to be keeping noble silence, so of course I'm not going to be lying. But in the context of a retreat, when we're not speaking outwardly, can be very interesting to pay more attention to the inner speech, to notice, is there harsh inner speech, abusive inner speech, untrue inner speech? Again, there's that opportunity to really refine this precept. Similarly, with the last one, to refrain from taking intoxicants which cloud the mind and lead to heedlessness. Probably we're not going to have access to alcohol and recreational drugs here, so there's a gross level of complying with that precept, but again, it can be an invitation to notice, where does my energy get agitated? Where is there some form of desire in the mind? So even things like devices can become an addiction, as Gil mentioned earlier. So again, refining this precept, we can start to notice, where is there some compulsive energy? And just the invitation to explore that and rein it in. Refraining from intoxicants of all kinds. So together, these five precepts are such a powerful, beautiful way of making a commitment as a group to non-harming on more and more refined levels. So I'd like to invite you as a group in call and response to take these five precepts together as we begin to weave this container to support our inner practice. So the first one, I undertake the training precept to refrain from killing living beings. I undertake the training precept to refrain from killing living beings. I undertake the training precept to refrain from taking what has not been given. I undertake the training precept to refrain from taking what has not been given. I undertake the training precept to refrain from sexual misconduct. I undertake the training precept to refrain from sexual misconduct. I undertake the training precept to refrain from false speech. I undertake the training precept to refrain from false speech. I undertake the training precept to refrain from intoxicants which cloud the mind and lead to heedlessness. I undertake the training precept to refrain from intoxicants which cloud the mind and lead to heedlessness. Thank you.
So let's take about 90 seconds to sit here quietly and savor, appreciate being here with a community of people with similar intention to practice on retreat, and to appreciate the motivation that brought you here to practice. It's quite significant what brought you here. And it's even more significant that you acted on it and showed up here. You will be supported by this through these days. So thank you, and the meditation hall is always open if you want to come and sit, so you can stay here and continue to practice if you'd like.